Voktur is inspiriting in that sense. It belongs to us while we're writing it. And then there is an act of passing that occurs when you publish a book.
Do you feel that same way about a motion picture?
Well, see, that's why I am not possessive about motion pictures made from my works and don't care that Lonesome Dove has this 21-episode series or that maybe it's good or there's a bad sequel called Return to Lonesome Dove. It has stopped being mine. It has stopped being mine in any internal and meaningful way. I'm very happy if good films are made from these books, and good films have been made from my books. But in a way, it just doesn't touch me. You know, I've gone on 9 books past Lonesome Dove. I can't be worrying about it.
You've been listening to a 1994 interview with the late Larry McMurtry, author of Lonesome Dove and other novels, while he was on tour for the novel Pretty Boy Floyd. Neither Pretty Boy Floyd nor Father Knows Best were ever filmed. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Good morning. Welcome to the May edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, here with...
I am Patricia Welch, librarian emeritus.
And our fellow host, OB, is not with us yet, but he may be in any minute. This is a great, great day. Our guest today is the author of a new book published this month, called Symphony of Secrets. His name is Brendan Slocum. Welcome, Brendan.
Thank you so much, ladies. It is a pleasure to be here.
I want to start off by just saying that I heard your interview over Christmas break. I was visiting in Texas. We were going to the mall. We heard you on NPR, and we did not get out of the car until your interview was over. When I got home that night, I downloaded your book.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I loved your first book, The Violin Conspiracy.
Oh, thank you. Wow. You can't really tell, but I'm blushing. I am.
Emma has been your one-woman Pacific Northwest promotional team.
Thank you so much.
I love the violin. I love music. I'm not a musician, but I love that musical instrument. And so I was determined that we were going to see if we could get an interview with you.
Well, I am really happy that it's here. It's finally here. I'm glad to be here.
Would you start off by telling us a little bit about your new book?
Yeah, absolutely. Symphony of Secrets is a story of America's greatest composer, Frederick Delaney. 150 years after his death, his foundation, run by his family descendants, discover a new piece by him, and they hire a musicologist to authenticate it right before a worldwide celebration. And during his research, this musicologist discovers this guy may not have written any of his own music, and it may have been written by a Black woman who we now know would be living with autism. and the family who runs the foundation will stop at nothing to keep it a secret.
Well, I like that fast-paced mystery vibe. It keeps you reading.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted a page turner when people, when I write, I want to entertain people. When I read, I want to be entertained. So it's let's keep the pacing going.
Your books are entertaining, but there's also this basis in history. You know, when I was reading it, all I could hear was dun 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 dun, and I was like, I couldn't even remember the name of the composer, and yet I know that, you know, what has been said about them is that they used to go into the jazz clubs or whatever where Black people were playing, and they would come out and take the music and get the acclaim. And actually, that has happened throughout the history of music and everything else, unfortunately, in this country. So tell us a little bit more about the historical basis generally, but also in your life. Well, not so much in this one as perhaps the other, but still, just tell us a little bit about what inspired you besides just being a rip-roaring great mystery.
Well, first, that piece that you're talking about, that is Rhapsody in Blue.
In Blue, right.
And it is George Gershwin.
Thank you. Yeah. I read the one in life where the obvious eludes me. The first Juneteenth celebration at the library, Sarah Memory, no longer with us, but a local giant in just terms of music education and also music performance, he had his community choir at the library, and they did William Grant Still in the backyard. So everybody knew about the father of Black classical music in this country.
That's right.
Oh, just great. Yeah, we have to say these names. We have
absolutely
to
absolutely every time. Every time. Yes. William Grant Still was phenomenally talented. And, you know, George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, you know, he actually stole that from William Grant Still. William Grant Still uses that in his first symphony, and it's the same theme, and it's just like, but you know, that whole going in and borrowing of musical themes and everything, when people don't get credit for things that they've worked so hard for and just earned, I just found that fascinating, because it's been, like you mentioned, it's been happening throughout history, you know, with music, and I just thought it would be a really interesting avenue to explore. He's a particular favorite of mine. My teacher introduced me to his music when I was in college, and she said, you know, I want you to play this piece, the Suite for Violin and Piano by William Grant Still. And I was like, you know, is this some British composer? Who is this? I'd never heard of him. She's like, no, he's a Black man. And I was floored. I said, why have I never heard of this guy? And his music is phenomenal. And I'm a huge mystery guy. So, you know, and I watch Perry Mason, you know, I watch old reruns of Perry Mason. And one day I was actually watching an episode of Perry Mason, and I said, wow, that sounds like William Grant Still's music. And sure enough, I went and I looked. He had actually written scores for Perry Mason for the TV show. And, you know, no one knows this stuff about this guy. And it's just, he's phenomenal. So I always want to, as a teacher, I've been a school teacher for over, you know, two decades. So I'm always trying to incorporate something in terms of learning. I always want people to be able to take something away, not just a good story, but if it's a musical lesson or historical lesson, I really want people to get something out of what they read, not just an entertainment factor.
So one thing I take away from this lesson is that Gershwin was a sampler like our modern day rappers.
That is safe to say. It's definitely safe to say. And stories like this is going, you know, it's going to get the word out that there are others out there who will never, names we may never know, and we listen to their music all the time, but they'll never get the credit for it. And hopefully we can do something about that.
Well, I was wondering about your character, Josephine Reed. Mm-hmm. She was neurodivergent. Is that the word?
That's it.
Why did you choose to create this character?
Josephine is really special. I wanted to make her neurodivergent because I've had the opportunity to work with, I've taught neurodivergent students. I've taught students who live with autism. My nephew lives with autism. My best friend's brother lives with autism. Another close friend of mine, her son, lives with autism. And I wanted to, you know, this is an underrepresented community. And I really wanted to portray people who live with autism in a positive light, because not only do we not get enough of their story, but when we do get their story, it's always something negative. So I wanted to portray them in a positive way.
Give us just a little bit about, just a tease.
Okay. We have two timelines, one in the 1920s, Jazz Age, New York, and one in the present day. In the present, Professor Bern Hendricks and his sidekick, Ebony Washington, are doing research into this new piece of music that has been discovered by the composer Frederick Delaney. And Bern, the professor, he knows everything about Delaney. He's his hero. He knows all of his music, knows all of his life. And, you know, he makes some discoveries that are a bit shocking. And in the past, Freddie meets Josephine in a club, and Freddie is a musician. Josephine is also a musician. And when the two of them get together, magic just happens. But which one of them is the real genius?
I read that, I know from what I read that Violin Conspiracy was published in 2022. Mm-hmm. And this book, Symphony of Secrets, in April of 2023. Whoa. I mean, I saw you in an interview where you said it took 2.5 to 3 months to write Violin Conspiracy. You're on a roll. You are on a roll. Is there another book, Germ, starting, or are you in the middle of another book already?
Believe it or not, I have already got my third and fourth books. I've already done the plots and the synopses, and I'm planning on finishing my third book by Labor Day. And I want to have book four finished by the summer of 24. I write fast. You know, I see people all the time. They're like, it took me 6 months to write one chapter. What are you doing? I don't understand. Just sit down and write. You know, and I'm just that type of person. If I say this is what I'm going to do, I do it. I think I get that from being a musician. I used to sit down and practice my violin 3.5 hours every single day, rain or shine, you know, regardless of what I felt or whatever I was doing. You know, this is my practice time. So with writing, it's the same thing. Yeah, I'm going to start writing at noon. And as soon as I get 3,000 words done, I'm done for the day.
Writing isn't all that you do. Your background isn't in literature and writing. I think we need to tell our audience a little bit more about your background, which to me makes all of this remarkable, to say the least. So why don't you give us enough so that our audience understands, for instance, why you're writing about violins all the time?
Okay. I started playing violin when I was 9 years old through a public school music program. And through violin, I was able to not only graduate high school, but go to college, go around the world, meet tons of people. And it took me into the world of music education. And I have been a music teacher K through 12 for about 23, 24 years now. And since pre-COVID, I got out of the classroom and I teach privately. My private studio, I had 22 students. But after my books were published, I had to kind of cut that down because as much as I wanted to teach all of my kids, I couldn't. So I'm only teaching like 10 students right now. But that's where, you know, and I also play in a string quartet.
And you have a podcast.
Oh, yeah. We have a podcast and yeah.
And you're in, okay, you're in a string quartet and you're in a rock band.
Yeah, I'm in a band too, yeah.
So how do you even fit this in? When do you write? What even made you say, I want to write a book? Because it's not like you're not doing enough.
Truly, it was COVID-19. The summer of 2020 was just, you know, it was awful for so many reasons, for so many people. So as a working musician, everything that I was doing completely stopped. Everything, all my lessons. I was actually at a wedding reception playing when I got the news that my next three weddings were totally canceled. So it was a scary time because that was my revenue stream. So when the government money ran out, you know, because I couldn't work, I had nothing to do. When the money ran out, I'm sitting on the couch eating, getting fatter and fatter and fatter, because eat Doritos all day long. I saw an advertisement for selling books in the age of COVID. Now, I'd written a manuscript like 20 years ago. I wrote my first book 20 years ago, and it is the best book that has never been published. It is an awesome, phenomenal book. And I submitted it. And the agent wrote me back and said, this book is absolutely awful, but you've got a good voice, so you should write what you know, and it's not science fiction. So I had plenty of time. So I wrote the first chapter of The Violin Conspiracy, and my agent said to me, and this is totally backwards from the way it normally works, he said, this is great. If you write this, I could probably sell this book. I said, well, I'm not doing anything else, so I will write. And I wrote every day, and in 2.5 months, I had the book done. And he was like, I'm going to go try to sell it. And a week later, ta-da.
Whoa, the age of miracles hasn't passed. Whoa.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm a super spiritual person, and I just think, you know, everything is happening for a reason. And that's my belief.
Would you give us a sampling of the book now?
Be happy to. I am going to read a little bit of chapter 12. It's called Jamming with the Fellas. This is where Freddie meets Josephine for the first time. Freddie Delaney would always remember the leaves in her hair, the night that Josephine Reed changed his life. Right then, Eli Evans, the upright bass player, was all up in Freddie's face, blocking out the lights, the club, and the handful of audience members swirling their glasses at the far end of the room. "Did you even look at the charts I made for you?" Eli said, his tiny mustache quivering with fury, nearly disappearing into his bottom lip. Freddie could smell the cigar that Eli had smoked several hours before. "I told you this would be a waste of time," Eli said to the group, and then to Freddie. "It's time for you to go, man. You did your best, but you need to go." Freddie couldn't believe he was hearing this. His bandmates, the band that he had put together, were firing him? How was this even possible? But Red Simmons was nodding his head, bobbing on the end of his neck like a baby bird. Freddie thought that at least one of the jazz combo should stick up for him, but they stood there, eyes blinking back at him. The lights in the Alibi Club beat down, seeming to underscore the pathos of yet again another empty house. Those lights were the reason that nobody had come. Freddie was sure of it. How could musicians try creating an atmosphere of mystique in this shabby, too bright dump? The Flophouse shouldn't be lit up like this. It was Saturday afternoon. It should be dark, magic, and serenading moonlight. Whiskey fresh out of a straw-packed crate, not watered-down hooch. "Come on, Freddie," said Eli. "It was better than rehearsal." The cold tendrils of failure were sliding like sweat down his back. "It's time for you to go, man," Eli repeated louder this time to the room at large. Eli was barely tall enough to play his bass without a stool, but now his baritone voice curled in the back corners of the club. Eli arranged the sets, called the rehearsals, and corrected Freddie, only Freddie, regularly. Freddie wanted to believe that he wasn't a failure. He was just unlucky to possess the wrong skin color. He needed them to understand at least his musicality was true. He wanted, all he'd ever wanted, was to play music, jazz, classical, blues, whatever, barely mattered. What mattered was the feeling he got when he was playing, that he was once everywhere and nowhere, that his music was reaching down to the hearts and souls of people who were listening somehow, changing them for the better. "It was better than rehearsal," Bobby Roosevelt put in. The drum player, heavyset with a threadbare suit coat, had dark pockmarks on his cheeks and a soft spot for Fred. "This time he managed to get through the whole third change with only 6 mistakes. He's getting better." An impenetrable ring of empty tabletops lay between the audience and the band members on stage. Only one person was close enough to have overheard, and she wasn't paying them any attention. Head down, hands folded in her lap. Freddie thought maybe their music had put her to sleep. "Fellas, take it easy," Freddie said. "I just haven't found the groove yet." "It's not all that easy to do when Red decides in the middle of Blue Ribbon to take it back to the edge." Red Simmons, the tenor sax. "It's called timing, Freddie." He leaned in close. 2 of Red's lower incisors had been capped with silver. "You just get into the groove too late." Bobby laid his drumsticks carefully on his beat-up snare. The nickel rim glittered on the stage lights. Freddie waited for Bobby to back him up, defend him again, but he was sliding the sticks into the edge of the drum set as if he were barely listening. "The point is," Eli went on, "this isn't working. I don't know if you just don't get it or if you just don't care."
Fast-paced. And also, in the voice of a musician, I'm curious to see how much of you are in these characters, how much of your life informs them.
Well, for Violin Conspiracy, I have an exact number. Violin Conspiracy, 92% of Ray, the main character, is Brendan. And for Symphony of Secrets, it's a little different. Byrne, one of the protagonists, is my late brother, Kevin Bernard. And I wanted to pay tribute to him. So his speech, his mannerisms, everything, I made sure to write the character that way because that was my brother. He was one of the most talented people I'd ever known.
Wonderful.
It reads like a cousin who you haven't seen in years who's telling you of his adventures.
I'm going to take that as a great compliment. I am totally going to take that one.
The world that you paint, you know, of the especially the classical music community, it's an indictment. And yet you've persevered and you've done well. But what would you say to a young musician? Because though in the end your characters prevail, I think it could be discouraging.
Oh, 100%. I agree. I'm not trying to paint myself as a Martin Luther King or anything, but I like to say that I will take the hits, all the hits that I have taken, I will take them and open people's eyes and let them know that different perspectives exist. I will take the hits so that the next generation does not have to. I will take it, I will bear it, I will come out with a smile on my face stronger so that the next Black kid who wants to play violin never has to go through what I went through. He will have just as much of a fair opportunity as his white counterpart. That's why, you know, I want people to know that things like this happen. Stories like this exist. Perspectives like this are valid. You know, they're different, but they are 100% valid. So I have to say, I applaud people who would not normally read a book like this or on a subject like this. I have to applaud them for opening their minds. And lots of people have said to me, I had no idea that this is what it was like for you. You know, I'm a white woman who lives in Southern California. I would never even have thought this. So, you know, thank you for bringing this to my attention. And, you know, you got to give credit where it's due. Okay, I'm glad that you were brave enough to get through it and to accept it and try to understand it. So I do appreciate people's opening their minds and expanding their consciousness.
I heard you say that you play more than the violin because you were curious and wanted to play other instruments. How many instruments do you play and what are they?
I play 10 instruments. And I can really rock them. People don't believe it when I tell them this, but I play violin, viola, cello, bass, piano, guitar, flute, clarinet, oboe, euphonium. That's 10. Yes.
Well, what is a euphonium?
It's like a small tuba. I played it when I marched marching band. I played in the marching band.
I've seen it. Okay.
Yeah. Same fingerings as a trumpet.
Okay.
So you are an inspiration. My grandson plays violin, viola, oboe, and tuba.
I like him already.
When we heard that interview, he's 14. He's freshman year. He's in symphonic band at high school. So when we heard that, I was like, I got to get this book for new. He needs to read this.
And I like him.
And when you said Perry Mason, I just laughed because if I can't get to sleep, I'll watch a Perry Mason episode.
I figured out who did it. I watched one last night. I was like, it was her. I know it was her. It was her because of this. I got it. That's always fun to do.
And one thing that I keep thinking of, Emma, is I have this picture of your youngest son when he was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something. And he had a social gathering, but I guess to keep him occupied amongst all these adults, he's sitting there with his little violin. He probably gave us a little mini concert at the time, but you know, it's out there. It's out there in pockets and places, and we just have to encourage our young people. But I also wanted to mention, you're very modest and heaven knows you're disciplined, but I'm looking and it says that you are a Nobel Educator of Distinction. You serve as an educational consultant for the Kennedy Center and as the concertmaster for the Nova Annandale Symphony Orchestra. You are the most disciplined, productive person in the world. I'm just sitting here saying, is it my allergies or am I just tired? Excuse me, I know some of this is my allergies, but the weight of what you do, I mean, is it, I guess this amount of discipline is required to enjoy life. Tell us a little bit about the podcast. How did that come about?
Well, the name of the podcast is How Music Can Save Your Life. And I was actually approached by Evergreen Podcast. Said, hey, you know, you have any interest in doing this? Have you ever done a podcast? I hadn't even listened to a podcast at this point. And I was like, sure, you know, I'm venturing into this new world of literature. Why not? Why not? You can do that too. So the team that I had was phenomenal. My producer, Hannah, you know, she asked, who would you like to interview? And I was like, I want to interview people who have similar stories, who can share their stories of success. And it's Black and Brown musicians who have their stories would read like you could interchange each name. It is incredible how we all have gone through the exact same scenarios and the successes and the failures and the struggles and the advice that they were given and the advice that they give. I learned so much from listening to these guests. I feel smarter every time I got to talk to someone. And not only are they incredible musicians, but they're incredible people as well. And just sharing their stories is so inspirational. And it is a fantastic listen. If anyone has ever been discouraged thinking that you can't do something for whatever reason, take a listen to any of those episodes in that podcast, and it'll give you the pep that you need. It truly will.
I have a burning question.
Uh-oh.
How did you decide on the plot for your first book? About how did you decide the violin was going to be stolen?
Unfortunately, that was part of the 92%. That is actually me. When I was in high school, my violin was stolen my senior year, right before I was supposed to go to college. And it was devastating. To this day, I feel like there's a part of me that is just ripped away that I'll never find again. Because the violin, that was my lifeline. That was my ticket, you know, to success. That was the only way that I was going to be successful. And it was just gone. So I know what it's like. And fortunately, I had amazing mentors in my life as well. So my teacher, my high school teacher, told some of her colleagues about the situation, and a patron who had a violin sitting in their house, no one playing it. I will let him use our family violin for 4 years through college. And once he graduates, just return it. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm always, anything that I can do for anyone else that's going to help someone, I will absolutely do it, because I know what it's like to need help and to get it, and for someone to care enough about you to help you, want to help you succeed. So anytime anyone says, hey, can you do this? The answer is yes, absolutely, because I know what it's like.
Why did you choose that title for your podcast, How Music Saved My Life? I feel like that wasn't a casual decision.
Not at all. It felt like the natural decision for me, because music truly did save my life. Had it not been for the violin, I would be in prison or I would be dead. I'm 100% sure of that. My friends that I was running around with, well, first, we were super poor when I was growing up. You know, it was violin rental or electricity bill. Well, we know it's going to win. So, you know, I often had to go without. And before I found the violin, the friends that I was running around with, you know, they were getting in trouble and I was right there with them. And I would have been, I have friends to this day who I grew up with who are in jail. And some who are, you know, they're dead now. And were it not for my violin, I would have been running the streets. Instead, I was practicing, you know, instead of breaking into someone's house, I was on my first trip. First time I ever got to go to New York was because of my violin. You know, I'm practicing for a rehearsal. I'm going to a concert and they're, you know, stealing stuff. So were it not for this violin, I would have been right there with them. And it truly did save my life. And I am forever, forever grateful to public school music programs for saving kids' lives, because not everyone is going to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. Not everyone's on that track. There are artistic people who need creative outlets. And thank God that we have these outlets to be able to find our way to succeed. And that's truly why I believe music saved my life.
Is Portland one of the places you're coming on your publicity tour?
the closest, unfortunately, I'm getting to the Pacific Northwest is the San Francisco. That's as close as I'm getting. And I'll be at the Bay Area Book Festival for 3 days in May.
Well, we're glad that you were here with us. And I have to say, you talk about the people who were guests on your podcast and how inspirational they are. But I have to tell you, listening to you, it has inspired me. Where the spirit moves you, if you follow it with a positive attitude and persist, it'll come through. I mean, just thank you for sharing your shine, your glow with us today.
Oh, okay, I really am blushing now. Okay, that's enough of that. Okay.
Thank you for saying yes to our interview.
Oh my God. Thank you guys for actually wanting to talk to me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I really, really, really appreciate the support. Thank you guys.
All right. That's it for the month of May. Thank you, Mr. Slocum.
Brendan, please. And thank you guys.
Bye-bye.
Listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.